Thanks for joining us on Streamlines, your source for water knowledge. I'm your host, John McMain, with South Dakota State University Extension. This is episode 8. Hello, everyone, again. This is John McMain.
And Anthony Bly.
And today, Anthony, we are discussing sub-irrigation.
Oh, my.
So sub-irrigation is basically using your tile in reverse.
Wow.
Yeah.
You
ever heard of such a thing?
Oh, yeah, I have.
Yeah?
Yep.
And so got a colleague of mine from North Dakota. He's at NDSU. He's the Extension Water Management Specialist up there and professor. And he works a lot with this concept of sub-irrigation. So using your tile system, not just as a tile system, but also as an irrigation system. And so we went through kind of the ins and outs of sub-irrigation with Tom, and it was really interesting the flexibility that a sub-irrigation gives you. But like every other practice we've talked about, almost every other practice, the site specificity or how really you need to customize that design
right.
for the site. No cookie cutters here. Anyway, I'll let Tom introduce himself, and then we'll get into some of the discussion.
Yeah, I'm Tom Scherer. I'm an Extension Agricultural Engineer and Associate Professor in the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at North Dakota State University. I've been here since 1991, and periodically up until about 1997, I would get a couple calls every year about tile drainage, but they really started to take off in 1999. And so since then, we've been doing a lot of workshops and a lot of research projects. As far as I can tell, this is not a new concept. I suspect it's been around a long time. A colleague of ours in Michigan back in the 1980s was doing a lot of research on small plots in sub-irrigation, even developed some computer programs to help guide spacing and so forth. So that takes us up to the present day where North Dakota, South Dakota, we're in this transition zone where the east side of the state probably gets a decent amount of rain. And as you get a little bit farther, we can periodically have droughts. So the obvious question is, once a farmer installs a tile, is, boy, is there a way I can put water back into here during those late July, August, when my crops are really developing the seeds, the ears, the whatever that I need to harvest to get the max benefit.
So not a new concept.
No.
1941. And it's crazy because like I look at stormwater and you can go back to ancient Greeks and ancient Romans and their stormwater management. And so it's interesting how these concepts get recycled and updated. And, you know, I come in here, the young whippersnapper, and I think I have this great idea and look in the literature or talk to Tom.
It's
and
been
it's
done.
Like, it's been done a long time ago, and it either was really successful or it was a miserable failure and I shouldn't attempt it again. But so as Tom said, he works a lot with sub-irrigation, and biggest thing with any type of irrigation is you need a water source.
Correct.
And it's challenging. Like you need the water when there's not much water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you need irrigation when your water source is also potentially drying up. But there are some efficiencies that can be gained with sub-irrigation as well as subsurface drip irrigation, which is discussed in a different episode on Streamlines. But starting point for sub-irrigation, this is kind of my first question of how it works, is where do you get the water from typically in sub-irrigation? What's the mechanism of operation for sub-irrigation?
You obviously have to have an entry point to put the water in, right? So different people have done it different ways. We have one gentleman up in north central North Dakota that put in one of those systems, and he's got 24 control structures that he pumps water to. And by the way, his water source is a drainage ditch that drains, I don't know how many square miles, six or 700. And so he's got a pumping system where he built an off-stream storage of several acre feet of water. And he's got his pump set up so he can either pump out of the ditch if there's water in it, or he can pump it into the pond to fill it up, or he can pump out of the pond. So that's his water source. And it's pretty decent water. It's a very expensive system, but he's been happy with it. So in that case, he's got 24 outlets from his pump. So he's got a lot of piping on it. It's an 80-acre field. And when he wants to drain, he lifts up basically a piece of PVC and lets the water drain out. But when he wants to sub-irrigate, he pushes that down and then pumps into that, and that's what sets the level that goes out into his tile. that's the first thing. As I mentioned earlier, you can pump into, if you got a lift station or you got a control structure, you can pump into them. The gentleman that pumps has a separate main at the upper end of his field. He's got three zones in it, 240s and 150. And then he's got a manifold where he can divert the water to whichever one of those zones he wants to. So he's pumping directly into that main and then letting water flow down the tile and seep into the ground. But you have to have some kind of control. I haven't yet seen a gravity flow system other than what I mentioned, you know, at the beginning and back in 1941. My understanding is in North Carolina, a lot of the Wayne Skaggs research, they were doing that. They were putting control structure into ditches and backing water up into their tile to sub-irrigate. But I haven't seen anything like that here.
Sounds complicated.
It is complicated. And one of the biggest takeaways I had when talking to Tom is how important it is to think about that conceptually when you're putting the system in the first place. Very difficult to retrofit, in my opinion, and in practice. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that you can just go get off the shelf, right? Throw in there and you're good to go. It's very case dependent. Very much has to be taken into account when you design the drainage system and the sub-irrigation system. It's, if you just think about the concept, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And like, you can make it work for your system, but if you don't think about it conceptually and you just try to do sub-irrigation based on other people's designs, it's not necessarily going to work for your field. So that complexity can be a benefit because you can tweak it. You can make it work. Like, you can be innovative with sub-irrigation. But if you're not innovative and you just take a cookie-cutter design, it's going to fail probably.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
So sub-irrigation, conceptually, great idea. But when the rubber hits the road, what's the opportunity for farmers?
That's what I want to know.
Well, I think first they have to realize there's two different ways of doing this. And we've got both here in North Dakota. The traditional way is to shut off the lift pump and then pump water into the lift station and back water up into the main and back it up into the tile, either with a control structure or, in our case, lift stations. And we've got some systems that do that. What we found is on a 0.1% slope, we can back the water up about 1,000 feet. Okay, you're trying to maintain that water level a couple of feet below the surface. So if your field is, say, 2,000 feet long, you probably have to have two mains in there. And we have one producer that has done that. He split his field and actually has two. The other way, which as far as I know, at the field level scale, we've got the only system that a farmer put in where he put a separate main at the upper end of the field and he pumps his water into there and then lets it run down the tile and then has control structures on the outlets to control the amount of water. And the theory is you put the water into the upper end, it goes down, it's going to seep out into the soil. What we kind of found is that if you put the water on too much, it actually just runs down the tile and doesn't seep out that much. So you get a large accumulation, usually right at the outlet by the control structure. And in one case, the sugar beet field, there was enough extra water in that lower end where the control structure is that they had a disease problem. They got pretty bad rhizoctonia because of the excess moisture. And so we found out that, at least for sugar beets, it probably wasn't worthwhile sub-irrigating that area. But gotcha. But that's not the same for soybeans, which has only about a 2-foot rooting depth. It really depends on the crop and how you're going to put the water in.
So what do you think?
There's challenges there.
And this is kind of where water management and other disciplines of agronomy would come in. I mean, disease pressure from excess water. Obviously, you're going to have, you know, rooting issues potentially with excess water. So that's a challenge if you're relying on management that may or may not happen, not because you don't want it to happen, but you may not have all the information you need to make the right management decision, or you just may not. I mean, that's another step you have to do, right, to go out and manage that system. So you might not have the time available to manage it, right? And then, yeah, you end up with a system that's flooded or saturated rather than one where you have a drainage system that's working properly.
It's learn as you go, I think.
I guess like a lot of things in life.
Yeah.
Sub-irrigation, right. Learn as you go. One of the things Tom mentioned was clay layers between the tile and the ground surface.
Sometimes we've got clay layers that are sometimes in between the tile and the ground surface when it was put in. you know, depends on your structure as you go down.
Anthony, have you seen subirrigation? I've actually never seen it in person, but
no, I've been to events where they've talked about it and presented their research projects.
One of the biggest challenges with designing and installing and operating a subirrigation system is if your soils and your subsoils are not consistent.
Correct.
And you can imagine how this would just wreak havoc on, you know, you're putting water where you think it's going, and in reality it's blocked by a clay layer or there's some preferential flow path or whatever the case would be. Like, there can be huge amounts of variability in a field, and so if you don't fully understand that whenever you put one of these systems in, then it's not going to work how you planned.
Correct.
And so one of the things that Tom recommended as far as advances in sub-irrigation design and technology is getting a better idea of what's going on in the soil.
I had one gentleman, he's got a piece of land, it's flat on the bottom and then it goes up a hill, okay? And the hill part is a sandy soil. It's a sloping, it's a pretty uniform slope going up. And typically the water drains from that area down to the low area. So he's got a lot of water in the low area and that needed drainage. And the upper end needed drainage too at certain times, especially in the spring. But as he got into July and August, that upper part would dry up, whereas the lower part had enough kind of natural flow of water underground to keep it okay. So what he set up is he set up a system where he just sub-irrigates that upper part, the sandy part. And he actually pumps out of his sump. He's got enough water in that lower part that he pumps out of there. And then he's got a small supplemental well that he can pump into there. So he pumps it up and he's got two, oh, I would say 30 acre blocks. He's got just two valves right there. So what he says when he's operating it, he doesn't have a tremendous amount of flow, but he pumps in one direction, one 30 acre chunk for about 5 days. And then he goes up and flips the valves and puts it the other way. And that water seeps down and then it moves downhill. So his drainage system is actually capturing any excess water he's got. Very clever design. He said, you know, his yields on that sandy soil went from 100 bushel corn to 200. You know, but he used existing topography and conditions to his benefit. And it's paid off for him. It was a sizable investment, but still, he says economically, it makes a big difference. So that extra 60 acres, you figure you get an extra 100 bushel corn or 20, 25 bushel soybeans, is economical.
Innovation is the name of the game here.
Innovation is the name of the game. Again, it's not, there are no designs off the shelf.
Nope.
You consider your situation and you design for that. And I wouldn't say it's a gamble necessarily. It's more about knowing how to work with the situation that you have, because you know if like that slope piece of ground burns up, it needs water. Right. So you know you're going to have benefit there if you can have more water on that piece of ground.
He knew he had excess water too.
And he knew he had excess. So, man, innovation, taking that excess water from the bottom, pumping it to the top. I mean, you're getting the double benefit from managing the water on the downstream end and on the upstream end.
Yeah, that's how I see it. I mean, it's all situational.
So one of the stories Tom told about was about a farmer who put in a drainage system and a sump, and he put the sump went in the middle of a sand vein unbeknownst to him, which was getting water from who knows where. And once that started pumping, it basically never stopped for the next 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
Because it's not just getting water from the drainage system. It's getting water from the whole county, basically.
Tap the aquifer.
Tap the aquifer, yeah. So, unfortunate situation. And a real example of why it's important to know what's going on under the ground if you're designing a system that's working with the mechanisms that are happening.
Absolutely.
Yeah, technology and remote monitoring of these things can help you a lot. One of the biggest things, I think, what we don't know about drainage, and I'd like to see somebody really initiate a a research project on this, and I think I've mentioned it to you before, is that all of our drainage design manuals and everything assumes that we know where the confining layer is or the restrictive layer is, right? My hunch is, in looking at a lot of fields, like I told some farmers in some areas, you got a geologically screwy area. You got layers of sand and gravel mixed in with layers of clay, and it causes strange problems sometimes. And I'd like to see somebody do some real monitoring of fields if we can use something like an EM31, some kind of monitoring system. You know, you're probably familiar with the EM38 that measures salinity, but that only goes down about a meter. And I know a colleague of mine works up in Canada, in Manitoba, works with a geologist who uses that. And they've mapped some fields and have been able to identify areas in the field where there's buried sand layer, sand channels from old glacial outwash. The reason they were doing it is these systems were not acting the way they expected to. And here they found these channels where they were like between 12 and 15 feet down. And so the water would seep down there, and it's going someplace where they didn't expect. So I'd like to see more research along that line. I know people have worked with ground penetrating radar, but I'd like to see something that can map out these layers, because I suspect in a lot of our fields, even though they look nice and flat, I think that confining layer undulates. And I think that would be a better tool for probably working out designs.
So it's really important to know what's going on under the ground. The EM31 tool that Tom mentioned, it's a ground conductivity meter, and that's able to get basically soil characteristics down to several meters or multiple meters versus just, you know, one or so meter with the EM38. And that's something that can be actually performed on a field for about $6 an acre. That was the figure that Tom threw out. Is that valuable information? Would you, if you were thinking about putting a tile system in, would you think about doing that on your system, your field?
You know, it depends on where your field's at. I mean, if it's in an outwash plain or any other floodplain type area that's been deposited by water, you know, that would be important. But like our windblown silts, our lush soils are really consistent, so it wouldn't be, you know, so valuable in those situations.
Because of the soil forming factors that were present for that soil.
Correct. I mean, our glacial tilled soils, it may have some advantage there to predict how deep that parent material is if it's more than a meter, which would be really valuable.
It's great to work with a soil scientist. Yeah. So one of the last things I asked Tom was kind of if he saw any technology that was, you know, really going to be groundbreaking for sub-irrigation. And we talked about solar, and I'll let him discuss that. But one of the biggest things was the concept of sub-irrigation is good, but it's not like you can make a technological breakthrough because everything is so site-specific. So you can make maybe a technological breakthrough on the overall concept, but again, like you said earlier, it's innovation at every field that makes a difference. You're not going to have a situation where you can pump to the top, let it gravity flow down the field. You're not going to have a situation where you can pump out of your sump to the top. Like, those are very situation specific. And so it requires innovation for every design. But there are some pretty exciting technologies out there.
I'm not promoting it, but ever since I've been doing tile drainage design workshops, there's always a question come up is, are there any solar options? And I've always had to say that, no, I haven't seen any. Well, our local gentleman that sells these lift stations all over the United States is now putting in a solar-powered pumping system. And by the way, he said he would hire an intern, or he's looking for an engineer that would work on these projects. And he's got more than just lift stations. He sells prepackaged VFD-controlled irrigation systems and grain handling systems, but he's going to be installing this solar system. So I'm hoping that that type of thing might work out. So that's one project. And there's always questions coming up about water quality. Three of us, Shinwa, myself, and then one of our area specialists up in Langdon, who's got a controlled drainage, are trying to put together an extension bulletin to show what results we've got from monitoring these different systems. As you well know, every system is different and what comes out of them is different. But we're starting on putting together an extension bulletin to kind of show some of the water quality. And we can't show all of the water quality, so we're going to just focus on TDS, EC, sulfate, because that's a big problem here. Probably chloride and SAR of the water. Those would probably be the main ones that we look at. We've got samples where we've got a tile outbedding into a drainage way. In some of our systems, we've taken samples upstream and downstream, and then what comes out of the tile on the same day. So you can kind of look at what's the impact of that tile outlet onto the receiving stream.
Sounds like water recycling to me.
It definitely fits, I think, with drainage water recycling. And there's a lot of opportunity for overlap with conservation drainage practices. And since this is a conservation drainage series, I wanted to wrap up with thinking about how sub-irrigation can contribute to these goals of conservation drainage. One being water quality. To me, the biggest thing is if you're able to capture and reuse through the tile, you're reducing what's going downstream.
Absolutely. The nutrients as well.
The nutrients as well, right. That gives another opportunity for those nutrients to be used by your target organism, the
plants.
The plants, yeah. And then the other piece of conservation drainage is this resilience piece of enabling drainage systems to be able to withstand extremes in the spring, too wet, and in the summer, too dry. And it does come back to a water source, but if you have a water source, sub-irrigation is a good way within the same infrastructure and within the same system to give you some of that resilience in the spring and the summer.
Absolutely.
So sub-irrigation, it's a pretty innovative concept, but it's not necessarily an easy one to implement, right? It has potential challenges.
You better make your plan.
You better make your plan. We heard about the sugar beet farmer who was too saturated and ended up with disease issues.
Correct.
We heard about the farmer who didn't have enough water because the flow was too high at the top end of the drainage system, so it all ran downhill.
Yep.
And then there's all this complex soil and drainage design, and like there's a lot of unknowns potentially with sub-irrigation. And so site-specific design is critical.
Very critical, but it's doable.
I guess going back to the maybe the most exciting thing about sub-irrigation is conceptually it's flexible if you're flexible. If you can innovate that system to make it work for your situation, it can pay dividends.
Oh, that's the exciting part.
That's the exciting part.
The challenging part.
That's the exciting and the challenging part.
Yeah, exactly, together.
Right. So sub-irrigation consistently results will vary. Thanks for joining us today on Streamlines. We sure had a lot of fun today. Hope you did too. If you want to learn more about anything you heard today, head on over to the SDSU Extension website. But for now, I'm John McMain.
I'm Anthony Vly.
And we'll catch you next time.